So once again, welcome to Insight Meditation Community of Berkeley. My name is Deb Kerr, and I've been a longtime student of James, and I owe him a huge debt of gratitude for many things that he's done to support me so that I can be sitting in this seat tonight. I took James's beginning class in 1991 and slowly ramped up my practice after that. Began doing retreats in 1996 and then was able to be in the first of Spirit Rock's dedicated practitioner programs. And as a result of that, James asked me and another woman named Quilly, who many of you may know, to lead a Kalyanamita group. So we started doing that back then, and then James was instrumental in helping me get into community Dharma leader training. So he's been a very dear teacher of mine, and I'm really grateful for that. I don't know if I need to say a whole lot more about myself. Let's see. As I became a community Dharma leader, I taught meditation in assisted living and skilled nursing facilities for 6 years, where I also worked as a speech pathologist. I've since retired, and I now teach at East Bay Meditation Center, and I still have that Kalyanamita group going on, and I teach at a sangha in Alameda as well. So I'm very pleased to be here tonight. I was looking around the room at all the beautiful Buddha figures here, and it's just such a lovely place to meditate. It's really sweet. This talk does have a title. It's called Surrendering to Reality. And I should have amended the title a bit. It's really finding freedom in surrendering to reality. So sounds a little less grim than the first iteration, I think. So I'm a person with a disability, and I'd rather not be, of course. Sometimes I can pass as more or less able-bodied. I often view myself as, quote, an able-bodied person who happens to have a little difficulty walking, which really isn't all that bad and certainly doesn't reflect on my overall competence or wholeness, so don't worry about it. But lately, my symptoms have worsened somewhat. I was recently on a trip to Norway. Sidebar here. I forgot to say that I'm really grateful for the warm welcome I received tonight at the potluck before the Sangha meeting. And as a result of that, I met Karin from Norway. And so we had something in common because I've just been to Norway. And that was a really nice connection, and I appreciated that. So as part of this trip to Norway I was recently on, I was on a small cruise ship for 11 days, and I was among a group of 50 older adults, most of whom were 10 or 20 years my senior, and I was clearly the least physically able among the group. I fell twice very publicly during the trip. I experienced a lot of pain compounded by the stress of trying to keep up with the group, the fear of falling again. I ended up feeling somewhat isolated, walled off in my own miserable, gimpy world. And I was frequently caught in comparing mind. Or I was suffering from how difficult it was to move during any activity. There was anger at struggling with the buffet meals. There was alternating laughter and panic as I staggered across the rolling deck. At times, I felt like a kite flying from the arm of my partner. And there was the specter of losing my independence. A big myth that I've had was dispelled. The myth goes like this. I can do everything anybody else can do. I just do it a little slower. Now, I have to laugh a little at my own telling of this tale because really on that ship, it was a deva realm. The food was great. We were very well cared for. There was fabulous scenery going by, and we learned a lot about Norwegian culture and history and got to meet a lot of wonderful Norwegian people. At the same time, I felt more and more like I was looking in a window at a world in which I can no longer fully participate. Admitting to myself that I have a disability is a big deal. It feels very dicey to me to do that. It feels like an admission of an inherent brokenness and vulnerability. It feels like something shameful. It feels like something which, if I embrace it, will doom me to a quicker downhill slide. It can be incredibly fear-inducing. This is a disease, but I persist in viewing myself as a healthy person. I'm not sick, I just can't walk too well. When I was a speech pathologist working in long-term care facilities with people often who had swallowing problems, I learned that no one likes to be told that there's something wrong with them. This disability certainly feels like there is something inherently wrong with me at my core, and I certainly don't want you to see it. I don't want to be judged by it. It feels more and more like a defining characteristic of who I am and something that is and will progressively box me in. After returning home from our trip, I was telling a friend about the suffering I was experiencing. My friend, who was also a Dharma teacher and has several difficult health conditions herself, said, "When I experienced my first seizure, I knew I had to surrender to the disorder completely. There were lots of things I'd never be able to do again." I was impressed by her statement and by the ease with which she seems to deal with her health situation. But surrendering is not something that comes easily for me. Yet after our trip, feeling like my walking had gotten a lot worse, I was caught in fear and dread, and it felt like I was roasting on a slow spit of grief. And all of it was being held at arm's length by a reflexive act of will that reflects, that says, I don't want this suffering. I really don't want it. I don't want to let it in. I don't want to admit it or allow it. My friend's statement about surrender, about surrendering, felt strangely like a life ring. And so I experimented a little bit with it. I surrender to having a disability, to being subject to the reality of imperfection, of illness and impermanence. I surrender. One reason surrendering is hard for me is that the disease that I have requires that I exercise and stretch a lot. And so surrendering might be letting go in a way that allows things to get worse. It might be a form of giving up. So a constant question for me is, do I need to accept what's going on right now? Or do I need to somehow work to change it? So if I'm walking, for example, and it feels really difficult, it's like, oh, is that just what's going on right now? Am I just being called to accept this? Or do I need to stop and stretch? Now, to me, this seems like a central question for meditation practice as well. Am I called to accept what is going on right now? Or do I need to change it in some way? For example, do I sit and meditate with this fear or anger? Or do I cultivate loving kindness? So that's kind of a central question that gets at the art of meditation. What do I need to do in this moment? How can I best be with the truth that's here right now? So once I was able to kind of a little bit surrender, I remembered, oh, yes, this body is imperfect. There is suffering in life. Things are impermanent. I'm not in control here. Something relaxed, and I could begin to let go of the struggle to make things different than how they are. This is not the first time that I've had a big wave of suffering related to having a physical disability. But this cycle was perhaps one of the more painful and scary ones. It's not just the physical suffering that is difficult. It's the mind states that come with it that are frequently as painful, if not more so, than the bodily difficulties. I'm sure many of you have had that experience when some circumstance in your life is not, you know, is really causing a lot of suffering, that the way the mind spins out with it is really adds to that suffering. Of course, the Buddha had a lot to say about suffering. There can be huge comfort in the fact that suffering is not a mistake. It's a normal part of life, and we can find freedom from it. The heavenly messengers of illness and aging and death were what first impelled the Buddha to seek liberation from suffering. You've probably heard of the heavenly messengers. I'm going to recap the story just briefly and read some quotes from Bhikkhu Bodhi, who has a really nice article on access to insight called Meeting the Divine Messengers. The traditional legend of the Buddha's quest for enlightenment tells us that throughout his youth and early manhood, Prince Siddhartha lived in complete ignorance of the most elementary facts of human life. His father, anxious to protect his sensitive son from exposure to suffering, kept him an unwitting captive of naivete. Incarcerated in the splendor of his palace, amply supplied with sensual pleasures and surrounded by merry friends, the prince did not entertain even the faintest suspicion that life could offer anything other than an endless succession of amusements and festivities. And that was kind of what it was like on the ship that I was on in Norway, actually, the endless amusements and festivities. Maybe not quite like the Buddha's palace, but it was good. It was only on that fateful day in his 29th year, when curiosity led him out beyond the palace walls, that he encountered the four divine messengers that were to change his destiny. The first three were the old man, the sick man, and the corpse, which taught him the shocking truths of old age, illness, and death. The fourth was a wandering ascetic who revealed to him the existence of a path whereby all suffering can be fully transcended. This charming story, which has nurtured the faith of Buddhists through the centuries, enshrines at its heart a profound psychological truth. In the language of myth, it speaks to us not merely of events that may have taken place centuries ago, but of a process of awakening through which each of us must pass if the Dharma is to come to life within us. The spurs to awakening press in on us from all sides, yet too often, instead of acknowledging them, we respond simply by putting on another layer of clothes to protect ourselves from their sting. And at another place in the suttas, the Buddha taught this in a slightly different fashion, in a way that correlates with these heavenly messengers. And this is called the three forms of intoxication. And I'm going to read, this is a translation by Tanisaro Bhikkhu of the Sakkamala Sutta. Again, the Buddha recounts the pleasures of his early life in the palace. Then he says, "Even though I was endowed with such fortune, such total refinement, the thought occurred to me, when an untaught, run-of-the-mill person, himself subject to aging, not beyond aging, sees another who is aged, he is horrified, humiliated, and disgusted, oblivious to himself that he too is subject to aging, not beyond aging. If I, who am subject to aging, not beyond aging, were to be horrified, humiliated, and disgusted on seeing another person who is aged, that would not be fitting for me. As I noticed this, the typical young person's intoxication with youth entirely dropped away." And he goes on to repeat this for illness. So when an untaught, run-of-the-mill person, herself subject to illness, not beyond illness, sees another who is ill, she is horrified, humiliated, and disgusted. If I, who am subject to illness, not beyond illness, were to be horrified on seeing another person who is ill, that would not be fitting for me. As I noticed this, the healthy person's intoxication with health entirely dropped away. And then again, in terms of death, when an untaught, run-of-the-mill person, himself subject to death, sees another who is dead, he is horrified, etc. And if I, who am subject to death, not beyond death, were to be horrified, that would not be fitting for me. As I noticed this, the living person's intoxication with life entirely dropped away. Practitioners, there are these three forms of intoxication. Which three? Intoxication with youth, intoxication with health, intoxication with life. And again, in another sutta, this is summarized as being a form of vanity. So the Buddha said, "I too am subject to aging, not safe from aging. When I considered thus, the vanity of youth entirely left me. I too am subject to sickness, not safe from sickness. When I considered thus, the vanity of health entirely left me. I too am subject to death, not safe from death. When I considered thus, the vanity of life entirely left me." I remember being a young speech pathologist working in hospitals and nursing homes and having that vanity. A subtle pride in my own quick movement, pity or disdain for those who were older or slower. And those attitudes are supported and perpetuated by our ableist and ageist culture. But clearly, they've been kind of universal through the ages too, so it's not just something that's particular to this time and place. So now I'm increasingly confronted with this heavenly messenger of illness and disability. The frail and quickly passing nature of our lives is revealed in this mirror of illness and disability, aging and death. I see this suffering in my life. Surrendering to it is a form of letting go, of undoing some of the clinging, of renouncing the need for things to be different than how they are. What are some basic attitudes, principles, or practices that would be helpful for everyone to keep in mind when this heavenly messenger of illness or disability visits them? I'm so grateful that as a Dharma practitioner and teacher, there's lots of tools to use, both to cope with the reality of having a disability and in helping me see disability as part of my practice. So here are a few of those tools. The first one is the one that I've been talking about so far, which is that of surrendering. Another way of saying surrendering is letting go or accepting things as they are. It's really letting go of the struggle to make things different, which is kind of always at the base of desire, isn't it? Desire has to do with wanting more of what's pleasant or wanting less of what's unpleasant. So it's always about messing with reality a little bit, changing it to meet our preferences a little bit more. But when we stop struggling against reality, we come into alignment with the truth, and a huge burden of stress falls away. Space opens up for the possibility of healing when we surrender to what is. You know, there's so much energy we put into that holding the unpleasant at bay. And when we can relax that struggle, already there can be some immediate relief. The next tool, the second one that I'm going to talk about, is remembering that I am not this body. Easier said than done sometimes. But this body has its own journey, its own causes and conditions. I don't need to cling to it as I or mine. I can let it be life's body. I can stop taking my disability so personally, and perhaps see it as part of the natural order of things. The fact that I have a disability is not an aberration. Sometimes it seems to me like it should be, but it's not. It's just what happens. It's what happens when you have a body. Certainly what happens when I have this body. Number three on this list of handy-dandy tools is practicing compassion. Practicing compassion for myself, for this body, for this mind and heart, and for others in similar circumstances. Surrendering, or that act of letting go, is what allows compassion to arise. Because again, as long as we're struggling with our suffering and keeping it at arm's length, the truth of it's not touching us. Compassion can't arise until we allow ourselves to be touched by our own suffering. So as soon as we do that, As soon as we allow ourselves to be touched actually by the pain that we're feeling, then the heart can respond with compassion. As we begin to have the compassionate wish to care for ourselves and to be free from suffering, it's also necessary then to allow ourselves to receive the compassion that's coming from ourselves or from others. So, and that can be almost trickier than offering ourselves compassion, to really allow ourselves to receive it. That's really hard to do sometimes. Because in a way, to receive compassion means we have to let go of suffering. And oftentimes our identity is so bound up in the struggle that we're having with the suffering, it's hard to set it down. It's very hard to set it down. Frequently now, people will offer me help in some way with some physical task. I'm practicing receiving that help as graciously as possible. If it's not help that I need, I'll say, "No thanks, and I'm really grateful for your kind offer." In all cases, I'm practicing seeing the offers of help as active forms of compassion, rather than as reflections of my own neediness or vulnerability. In this way, those offers that I receive from people bring a lot of happiness, and I feel that I am born on a wave of loving kindness. So it's like, wow, there's something really powerful about choosing to view other people's offers as compassion rather than as remaining in a contracted place where I say, oh, I can't accept your help because that means that I'm vulnerable and needy, which I think is a tendency that we have a lot of the time. Item number 4 is practicing patience with whatever's happening. When I feel the reactivity of anger or fear or despair, patience allows me to stay with my immediate experience. It's like, oh, I can be patient with the difficulty of doing XYZ right now. So that allows me to settle back into the present moment and relax a little bit. And then I don't add the second and third and fourth arrows of suffering that come when the mind flails out in reactivity. So I find patience to be hugely, hugely beneficial. The next one's gratitude. So practicing being grateful for what I do have and for what I can do. My walking ability may feel like crap, but much of the rest of my body works tremendously well. So I'm grateful for my good digestion, my healthy lungs and liver, my relatively good memory and eyesight. I may not be able to hike to the top of the mountain, but I can be grateful to be in a place with a beautiful view of the mountains. There are so many other blessings in my life. A loving and supportive partner, closeness with our daughter's family, the opportunity to travel, and so on. And any of these can be a jumping off point for a whole stream of gratitude. Number 6 on the list, for those of you who are counting. Practicing mudita for others' health and ability. Now, you may be familiar with mudita as a term. It means sympathetic joy. It means joy, sympathetic joy. It's one of the 4 Brahma-viharas that the Buddha taught, which are really 4 different aspects of love. 4 different flavors of love. So loving kindness is the basic wish for ourselves or others to be happy. When loving kindness comes in contact with someone who is suffering, it changes a little bit into compassion, into the wish for that person to be free from suffering. When loving kindness comes in contact with someone who's experiencing a lot of success or happiness in their life, it becomes the wish for that happiness to continue. That's mudita. And just to complete the picture, the fourth of these qualities is equanimity, which is the balanced quality of love, which can not be knocked off course by coming in contact with suffering or the exuberance that can come with coming in contact with happiness. So anyway, mudita is the wish for the happiness of others to continue. So I admire people's beautiful, strong, and graceful legs and how they walk or run. I can easily slip into envy about that. Sometimes it's a mystery to me how someone can do that with their legs, how they can run so well. So consciously looking at someone walking easily and beautifully, I will wish, may you enjoy your strong legs and your beautiful walking. Or may your ease and grace continue. This changes my mind state from being contracted in envy to having a heartfelt sense of enjoyment for the physical beauty of another human being, for the blessings in their lives, and for the human form in general. You know, these are amazing animal forms that we inhabit. Amazing, miraculous pieces of biological engineering. Philip Moffat calls them our spacesuits, right? Okay, just two more. You're hanging in there really well with this long list. The next one is being in community. Especially practicing the Dharma with others who are experiencing similar heavenly messengers, which I know I'm speaking to the choir here, right? We all are in one way or another. So Sangha is a powerful tool for finding ways of working with pain, for lessening isolation. You know, there's a tendency to think I'm the only one suffering like this, right? Well, I know that I'm not. I know that we're all suffering in our own unique ways, and that it's really easy to feel that our particular form of suffering is unique to us, but there are many others who are experiencing similar situations. So Sangha is a powerful tool also for increasing our compassion, both for our own suffering and the pain of others. I can't stress the importance of this enough. When we come together to share and to support each other, especially in the light of the Buddhist teachings, powerful healing can take place. And number eight on this list is dedicating our pain and suffering to the liberation of all beings. Now, that can sound a little counterintuitive. This is a practice that's related to the Mahayana concept of the Bodhisattva. The Bodhisattva is one who delays his or her final liberation until all beings are free. So we can, in that sort of intention, we can say, I dedicate my suffering to the liberation of myself and all beings. Or, may my suffering serve to help all beings find freedom. Now, this can seem like a shoving away of my suffering or wanting to hand it off in some way. But it's really not that. It's not an attempt to get rid of it. But rather, it's a willingness to experience it consciously for the potential it may have to bring freedom. So I'm going to read a little bit more now from Bhikkhu Bodhi. To become divine messengers, the facts of aging, illness, and death must jolt us into an awareness of the fragile, precarious nature of our normal day-to-day lives. Aging, sickness, and death are not only emblems of the unsatisfactory nature of mundane existence, but pointers to a deeper reality that lies beyond. The final word of the Dharma is not surrender, not an injunction to resign ourselves stoically to old age, sickness, and death. This is the preliminary message, the announcement that our house is ablaze. The final message is other, an ebullient cry that there is a place of safety, an open field beyond the flames, and a clear exit sign pointing the way of escape. If in this process of waking up, we must meet old age, sickness, and death face to face, that is because the place of safety can be reached only by honest confrontation with the stark truths about human existence. We cannot reach safety by pretending that the flames that engulf our home are nothing but bouquets of flowers. We must see them as they are, as real flames. When, however, we do look at the divine messengers squarely, without embarrassment or fear, we will find that their faces undergo an unexpected metamorphosis. Before our eyes, by subtle degrees, they change into another face, the face of the Buddha, with its serene smile of triumph over the army of Mara, over the demons of desire and death. The divine messengers point to what lies beyond the transient, to a dimension of reality where there is no more aging, no more sickness, and no more death. So surrendering to the heavenly messengers is the first step, but we don't stop there. Accepting reality leads us in the direction of complete liberation, of going beyond our clinging to things that can never provide lasting happiness. Coming face to face with the heavenly messengers brings me in direct contact with the Buddhist teachings on impermanence and suffering and not self. Each one of these, the three characteristics they're called, impermanence, that there is suffering, and that nothing can be taken to be independently attributable to I, me, or mine. Each one is considered a gateway to freedom, and each one can bring about a profound letting go. Sometimes this letting go feels more like having one's fingers pried loose from whatever we're clinging to. In my case, I feel like I've been being pried loose from my clinging to an identity as an able-bodied person. It's possible to surrender to relax with, and be mindful of that sense of prying loose, all the while taking refuge in the possibility of freedom to be found on the other side of letting go. So let's just sit for a moment. Here's a poem by Dana Faulds. It doesn't always smell like roses. This body is not flowing with liquid energy, no, and this mind is not awash with peace. I fight myself in every posture, muscles shriek, fear freezes bone, and a sure sense of failure grows. This too is practice, this ground where grief gains the upper hand, and anger casts dark shadows. This, the flip side of delight, is as much the point as any pleasure. This is breathing into life. And one more by her called Birthright. Despite illness of body or mind, in spite of blinding despair or habitual belief, who you are is whole. Let nothing keep you separate from the truth. The soul, illumined from within, longs to be known for what it is, undying, untouched by fire or the storms of life. There's a place inside where stillness and abiding peace reside. You can ride the breath to go there. Despite doubt or hopeless turns of mind, you are not broken. Spirit surrounds, embraces, fills you from the inside out. Release everything that isn't your true nature. What's left, the fullness, light, and shadow, claim all that as your birthright. So we have a little time for comments, objections, questions. Yes, please. Wait for the mic.
I would imagine that the answers would be the same, but I'm just wondering if you had anything different or additional or whatever to say about mental illness as opposed to physical illness, where it's not always acknowledged, people don't see it, they don't believe it. It is absolutely as much suffering as any physical disability, but seems to kind of be the...
Thank you for mentioning that. It can be so hidden and... Yeah, like you say, just hard to, you know. I think the other thing with mental illness is that there's even more stigma attached to it. Perhaps there can be a real flavor of, you know, this is your own fault in some way. So I think all of the same sort of tools apply, and especially compassion. You know, I think that's probably the compassion for the isolation, the hidden nature of it, etc. Do you have more to add?
No, just you know, the stigma really causes, I think, a lot of extra suffering.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's like Well, obviously we can't necessarily be in charge of our bodies, but we should be in charge of our minds, right? And we should be able to, I don't know, you know, transcend that or not have it happen or something. I think as practitioners sometimes that's especially a trap we can fall into, that, oh, if I were better at meditating, I'd be able to, you know, fix this or modify it. I had that view about my own body for a long time too, that there must be something, some way that I'm holding myself too tensely or, you know, whatever. Just the stuff that you get into adds so much more suffering to what's already going on. So thank you for bringing that up. Back at the back.
You finished there with an interesting point. There might be times where the contracting the muscles does contribute to the suffering. And so you mentioned about the art of meditation and knowing when to do one thing, when to give compassion, when to be with your fear and all. And I think it's just really an important point. It's all an art. It's a work in progress, and there isn't no real answer. It's a process that we're working with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the very same problem may require one solution in one moment, and which is more on the side of accepting what's going on, and the solution that's more active in the next moment. That's the essence of the serenity prayer, really, and it's a real hinge point of what we're doing, I think, every moment in meditation. So, yeah.
Well, I had breast cancer 25 years ago, actually, and I was working with a fairly large group of people, and I needed time off for surgery, and a lot of me was embarrassed. I felt it, talking about it brought attention to part of my body I consider private. But I made the decision not to make it a secret. And I'm really glad I did, because secrecy brings shame. And I got a lot of support and understanding from people, and have ever since when I've shared it. So I just wanted to say that if you can tough it out and not keep it a secret, I think it's helpful.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Definitely. Yeah. And that was a time when it was much less talked about and there was still a lot of stigma, a lot of emotional load attached to the disease. Yeah.
I also like to swim, so I've had to go into locker rooms and felt like, gee, my body isn't like other women's. But again, I've gotten support, never anything negative.
Mm-hmm.
So it has been hard sometimes to do that, but it's been worth it for me to not have a secret.
And you never know what effect that's had for others who later on may have had to, you know, deal with exactly the same thing. And like, oh, there was that woman who handled that with grace. That can be a model for me for how I can do this.
I have gotten that feedback.
Yeah. Yeah. So thank you. Right here.
I really appreciate your deconstruction of your own process as you're dealing with your physical challenges, and physical challenges usually connect. There is a mental response to the physical challenge. I remember I was in my 20s, fairly a competitive athlete person, and I was competing in martial arts, and I got my hips dislocated in during the fight, during the combat, and I was very much disabled for quite a while, and I was in my 20s, and I remember the pain of the powerlessness and helplessness that my body is not doing what it should be doing. And I was incredibly miserable. And that was an incredible lesson to learn at such a young age. Because now that I am in my 40s and I continue to have injuries, I mean, I have the full cycle of how to take care of myself. And a lot of it is really mental. It's up here. What I tell myself about my injury, what I tell myself about my limitations. But I think the shame that goes with that, the anger, the incredible rage that goes with that, especially when your ego as a young person is still very active, it needs that validation from society and you're not able to deliver on that, there is nothing that helps but a spiritual solution.
Yeah.
Just wanted to share that perspective that it's not just about being old, it's also you can have an accident as a young person and you experience all this
right.
cycle of suffering and acceptance and making peace with it. And something that helped me tremendously is being in community and to talk about it to other people. So I really appreciate you talking about the Sangha and the community. It was very, very helpful for me to share that with another person and actually accept help, because sometimes we feel like we cannot ask for help. We're too bad or too good for help. So
right.
I really appreciate your perspective on this.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. Forced out of that vanity of youth and health in a really traumatic way. Yeah. Yep.
I was really touched. I was really touched when you talked about struggling to keep up with the group.
Mm-hmm.
And, just think about all the ways that I sort of assume or take for granted the wellness of others.
Mm-hmm.
And I just feel... it's another reminder to me to be really sensitive and
mm-hmm.
caring. And trying to be inclusive to the people around me. So thank you for sharing that.
Mm. Thank you for saying that. Yeah. One of the places that I teach is at East Bay Meditation Center, and we have a group there called the Everybody, Every Mind Sangha, where I'm one of the teachers. And it's been such a process of healing for me to be in that group and pretty much overcome the self-consciousness of walking how I walk in front of other people. Even walking in here tonight and walking up on the stage sometime back would have been really difficult for me to do. And so to be with others who get it and who can, you know, support each other in that letting go of that part of identity and just, you know, just supporting each other. It's really very, very dear. So, yeah.
I was also really touched by your openness of your story, and I think also, because I've also gone through an illness that affected my, basically served as a disability for like 5 or so years, and understand that comparing mind of being a young person and then, and also like looking healthy. And I think that one thing for me is it really served. Now I can look at it as like a blessing, because the only way I was able to get through it was my practice and having to change my lifestyle. And so now I feel like I have this ability to touch in with myself and listen to my body that I wouldn't have without that. And so in that way, that sort of the blessings that can come, I mean, it can feel hard to see it that way, but the blessings that can come from that hardship, and I mean, that's what the Buddha taught you, you know, that suffering, but of how it sort of leads you to the practice. And so in that way, it can be a blessing that not everyone gets until, so.
Yeah. Did you ever think you'd be saying those words?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's like I basically needed the practice to get through it.
So. Yeah, and then not only did the practice help you get through it, but then, at least for me, it gives me such faith in the practice.
Yeah.
The power of the practice that's shown by that ability to get through something really difficult increases my faith in the practice being able to take me further, too. So, thank you. All right, we need to close, so let's hunker down and do some loving kindness practice. So let's go back into the body. And notice the breath and the heartbeat. Notice the three-dimensional field of aliveness that is the body. And remember your intentions for being here tonight. Remember your capacity for goodness and kindness. And your deep wish to be happy, to be free, to be peaceful. And honoring that intention and goodness in yourself. Holding yourself with great tenderness and care. May I be safe. May I be peaceful. May I be happy. May I be free. And now extending that wish to each other in this room, wishing each other, may you be safe, may you be peaceful, may you be happy, may you be free. And then gathering up all of our goodness, all of our intentions for peace and freedom. Holding each other tenderly and letting that spread outward into the world in all directions. First touching all those we love. And then opening wider to include all those we know, and finally extending in all directions to include all those we don't know, wishing each one without exception, may you be safe, may you be peaceful, may you be happy, may you be free. We dedicate our work here tonight to the awakening of each other and all beings everywhere. May all beings come to the end of suffering. May all beings know their true nature. May all beings be peaceful and happy. Thank you for coming tonight. Thank you for your attention and your participation. Thank you for your practice.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.